IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to another episode of All Things Policy. I'm Anushka Saxena, a research analyst with the Takshashila Institution's Indo-Pacific Studies program. And today I'll be speaking to Manoj Kevalramani, the chairperson of the program, on the recent developments from the two sessions in China and what some of them may mean for China's policy priorities for 2024. Welcome to the episode, Manoj.
Thank you so much for having me, Anushka.
Between March 5 and March 11, the two sessions, which is the annual meeting of the National People's Congress and the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, was underway. The 14th NPC and the CPPCC have met to discuss the Chinese economy, foreign policy, national defense, domestic politics, and much more. And just a little bit for our listeners, the NPC is China's quote-unquote, highest organ of state power, which means that it is its top national legislature. And the CPPCC is the top political advisory body that collects policy advices from local governments and cultural and state institutions and helps in shaping policy in the country. The 2024 session is the second session of the 14th rounds of the NPC and the CPPCC, and the first one was held last year. And this was also the two sessions of many firsts. The first time the new Chinese Premier Li Qiang presented his government work report. Also the first time the Premier didn't have a press conference at the end of the NPC. And the first time the new quality productive forces terminology became part of the annual priority agenda of the government, even though it's not really the first time the phrase itself has been used officially. So Manoj, if I may come to you and ask my first question, what is this government work report that the Premier presents? And what does it tell us, especially vis-a-vis China's economic, security or domestic policy prerogatives for 2024? And more specifically, what do you make of the much-awaited GDP target that has been announced as part of this report, which is 5% for 2024? Over to you, Manoj.
Okay, thanks so much. That's a bunch of questions. Firstly, what exactly is the government work report and why should we care about it? I think that people should look at this week of the two sessions of the NPC and the CPPCC as essentially a mix of pageantry along with some substantive work. It's sort of like, for Indian listeners, it's sort of like the Indian budget being presented, but it's also sort of like the State of the Union, although it's not the top political boss delivering it. But that's essentially what the government work report is sort of like, right? It's a there are budgetary implications, although it doesn't necessarily talk about specific allocations. But it talks about policy priorities. At the same time, you get some data points about, what are the targets for economic and social development for the year ahead. So if you want to understand in which direction economic policy is going to go, this is the document that I think is useful to follow. It also has, again, legal implications, because in some things you might want legal regimes to be created, and that will also be reflected in this. Although there's a separate document that comes out, which is the NPC work plan, which is presented by the leader in charge of the NPC during this week, that lists out the legislative priorities. So yeah, so this government work report is sort of like that, right? It's the economic state of the union. And at the same time, along with this report, you get the national budget estimates that come out and so on and so forth. So a bunch of documents for you to understand where money is going to be allocated and what are the economic priorities. What did Li Qiang talk about in his report? I mean, like you said, there's a GDP target which everybody looks at every year. because it tells you a little bit about how the leadership is thinking about what kind of goals they want to achieve. But also, if you set a certain kind of GDP target, it also has implications for government spending. It also sends an indication to local governments as to what they need to do and what is a preferred sort of goal, right? So local political sort of incentives are set up based on that. So I'll give you just a flavor of what kind of targets we sort of see in the work report. So Li Qiang this time talked about what is the GDP deficit to GDP ratio for the year, what kind of special bonds will be issued, what kind of allocation that the central government will make for local governments, what is the grain output target for the year. There will be data on, say, what is the sort of inflation target for the year, what is the target that they plan to sort of at least in their mentally for jobs in the year. So there'll be approximate target. So you'll have these kinds of targets which are set, and therefore they set the benchmark for everybody else to work on. Along with that, there will be priority areas that will be identified. So like say, in 2024, a bunch of tasks that he listed. The first task was this broad idea of, you know, modernizing your industrial system, developing, like you said, new quality productive forces. And under that, obviously, what are the subsectors and sectors that you want to focus on to be able to achieve this modernization of the industrial system? Another objective is, you know, science and technology promotion, starting from education to, innovation and breakthroughs. So what is the system that you need to have in place? So these are very, when you read the government work report, you will get a sense of, oh, this is very broad and this is very vague. But that's the idea, right? It's supposed to identify priority areas and then you sort of correlate that with the actual budget allocations in different domains to see whether the priority areas are being funded. So that's essentially what the government work report is and why it matters and how you can sort of make sense of it along with the budgetary documents. The second question that you asked was the GDP question, right? The 5% GDP.
Exactly.
So famously on an episode of All Things Policy, actually on two episodes of All Things Policy, I had made a prediction saying that this year we will see Li Qiang not announce a GDP target. Clearly he did not heed my advice. That's his bad. I had given him very good advice. At the end of the day, look, like I said, the GDP target creates a certain kind of pressure on government spending. At a point of time where China needs to shift away from its old model of supply side, investment driven growth, it would have been better if you had not announced that GDP target. But I understand why it's announced, because it creates a benchmark for local governments and so on and so forth. I thought this was a good time to break it. Now, whether China can achieve this 5% GDP target, I think there's been lots written about this already. My sort of brief take is that I agree with the idea that this is a target without a plan. It's not clear as to how you're going to achieve this target. If the spending allocation that we see, which he outlined in his speech, you know, which is essentially, let's say, deficit to GDP ratio of 3%, which is exactly what the target was last year, although it was increased to 3.8% in October after they issued a trillion RMB worth of extra bonds. Today, this year, they're saying same 3%. At the same time, they've allocated an additional 1 trillion RMB worth of ultra long-term bonds, which will be used for specific purposes. This is not included in the budget deficit. So I presume there is some room later on to maybe increase spending. But even if you take all of this numbers together, you don't necessarily get the sense of where, you know, if your inflation rate is going to be the same as you've planned last year, although last year the actual inflation rate was very, very low. It was 0.2%. This time you're planning to keep it at 3%. So if your rates are going to be the same as you had planned last year, and last year you struggled to achieve the growth despite their inflation being low, despite you being in a deflationary cycle, I don't see how you're going to hit your 5% GDP target. So it's sort of like a target without a plan. So therefore, I don't understand how they plan to hit this. The only way I think that this will be hit is by doing more borrowing and by doing more, therefore, investment. But at present, you've not budgeted for it. So perhaps sometime later in the year, you will see more money flowing if you want to hit it. Or at the end of the day, all these targets are political numbers pulled out of a hat. So, you know, there will be jugglery which tells you 5% has been met. But I don't think that is the real growth of the economy that's likely to happen. And therefore, I say I don't see the utility of setting the target. But yeah, but that's what my take is on the 5% GDP target.
Right. No, I think all of these 10 major tasks, as you rightly pointed out, do set out the policy prerogatives and priorities, albeit in a very vague manner, with some of them not attached to real concrete action plans. And for example, just the target on trying to achieve the GDP target that they've set for themselves through deepening of supply side reforms and expansion of domestic demand. Both of those are really challenging given that neither any expansion in liquidity or sending a higher inflation target, setting a higher inflation target have really worked so far. So yes, indeed, that was a bad policy choice.
I'm glad you agree with me that was a bad policy choice. That perhaps means that the coffee that I owe you is now stand cancelled.
Oh, well, sure. Only if I was working for China, but that's not the case. So we'll deliberate that. But on the point that you raised about new quality productive forces and how that essentially means deepening reform in the industrial sector, making it more technologically advanced. Can you talk just a little bit more about what are the sub-targets under this priority task? It's number one on Li Chang's list, according to the government work report. And so it must mean more than just new quality productive forces. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those phrases and buzzwords which for the last year and a bit has become quite prominent. So it's worth first sort of understanding what exactly does this new quality productive forces business mean, right? And to be honest, it's quite straightforward. And I'll quote from a commentary from my favorite newspaper in the world, the People's Daily. It explains what they mean by this. They say new quality productive forces represent the evolutionary direction of advanced productive forces, which basically means the evolutionary direction of new growth avenues, drivers. These arise from revolutionary breakthroughs, innovative allocation of production factors or factors of production, and deep transformation and upgrading of industries. So basically what he's saying is that new quality productive forces basically means new drivers of growth. These drivers of growth are essentially characterized by three primary sort of features. They are high technology based, so they are technologically advanced. They are high efficiency based, so that they produced higher at lower input cost. And third, they are of higher quality. That means that what they are producing may be the same output, but of better quality. So, right? So it is about infusing new technology into traditional industries. It is about also identifying industries of the future and investing in that. So in a nutshell, when they talk about new quality productive forces, this is what they are saying. So let me give you a simple example for this. This could mean investing in high-end semiconductors, which is a new quality productive force. It could mean investing in high-end robotics. That's your, you know, new, that's your sort of emerging tech domains. It could mean quantum computing and so on and so forth. But it could also mean investing in new processes for, say, furniture manufacturing so that the quality of furniture that you produce is far better than what it was. I mean, I'm sure most of our listeners are old enough to realize, to remember the time when, you know, the idea of made in China was associated with cheap, poor quality products. You know, cheap but poor quality, right? So this is what he's saying here is that, yes, we still make the cell phone, we still make the furniture, we still manufacture the shoes, but the processes on that and the quality of those products has to be uplifted, and that has to be done through infusion of technology, advanced processes, and so on and so forth. So that is, in a nutshell, what new quality productive forces means. Now, why is it important? It is important because you're looking at a stage in which low-cost manufacturing in China for traditional industries is not necessarily as viable anymore, partly because of basic economic advantage having shifted, right? So wages, labor, you know, all of that has changed, right? The externalities of these, the negative externalities of these, whether it's related to environment or so on and so forth, are no longer politically acceptable. So you're sort of shifting some of this stuff to other parts of the world where it may be viable. But that does not mean that you need to shift the entire supply chain, right? So there are some can be shifted, but if you actually improve quality, let's say in terms of chemicals, how do you deal with discharge? And can you deploy technology for that, for processes to become more safe, environmentally friendly, so on and so forth? So that is the idea of this. And the idea, therefore, is that you not only maintain, but you strengthen and upgrade China's manufacturing industrial base, but you do it through the infusion of technology, better processes, higher efficiency, and to produce better quality outputs. So that in a nutshell is what new quality productive forces is. And therefore, you can see why it is the first task in Li Qiang's government work report, because that is the growth model that China, that the leadership currently wants to follow. It, you know, I remember I was at a conference sometime back and there was an analyst who basically said that the model that Beijing wants is to create a Leninist German manufacturing model, you know, high-end engineering, whatever manufacturing model. But under a Leninist system, as sort of makes sense, right? That is what they want to do. And if you see last year where investment went, more went into manufacturing and higher end manufacturing and technology than say property sector and things like that, right? Property sector declined, whereas those are sectors where the money was allocated far more. So I think that that is why it is the top priority, because this is the growth model that you want to see. And if you see Li Qiang's work report, he talks about specific sectors, right? He talks about you know, new energy vehicles, intelligent vehicles, new materials, drugs, biomanufacturing, commercial space flight, life sciences. So there's a whole range of new areas that they want to focus up while addressing, also while strengthening traditional industrial base in specific domains also.
Stay tuned to All Things Policy. We'll be right back after a short commercial break.
No, that makes sense. And I think my biggest takeaway from this is the point that you made about increased efficiency, because if I have to reference one of my favorite newsletters and a conversation that was hosted on this podcast conducted by Ginger River Review, it was argued that the reason why there is now also a need to focus on new quality productive forces, which, you know, mark a shift from, like you said, the conventionally understood notion of just focusing on growth and export orientation, which could mean cheap production, but faster and in a larger volume. So the shift away from that to high quality production, high quality development of industry is also because there is a need to induce efficiency vis-a-vis total factor productivity, because soon China will be at a per capita income stage where its progress any further would not just be possible because of the utilization of capital available or investment available, but would really need that push from technological advancement, as we've seen with, say, more advanced economies like the US, to really be able to catapult growth and progress. So, and, you know, it aligns very clearly with the goals of China trying to become a middle-income economy fast and bringing about a rise in the income, in the per capita income level. So, definitely, that seems one of the key pillars for the prioritization of this. Another factor where the science and technology focus and the innovation focus that has really come up is defense industry innovation. And again, there's always a lot of buzz with these government work reports surrounding the number that is allotted to defense spending. This year, again, there has been a 7.2% increase. And last year, it was reported that 100% of the defense budget was also used. So in your understanding from what was said at the two sessions, what do China's national security and defense priorities look like? Where do you think this budget will really go in 2024?
Whenever a government department says that we have used 100% of the budget, you know, you know, you should applaud them because they know what is required to ensure that their budgetary allocations keep increasing. Whether the utility is productive or not is secondary. So, having worked in Chinese state media where, again, budget was allocated, it was not obviously market-driven, I have a deep understanding of how much pressure one feels to finish the budget. So I think I appreciate them saying that. But I mean, look, this idea of 7% increase in budget is being problematic or anything like that. I mean, I don't read too much into that sort of stuff. I don't think it is abnormal. I don't think it is shocking, alarming, any of that stuff. I think it is, if you look at what China is trying to build, and it's trying to build, and its stated goal is to build a force that can operate at global scale. You know, I'm not saying that it's trying to build a force in which it can plant aircraft carriers in the Atlantic Ocean next to the United States. But I think that there is enough and more evidence to tell us that Beijing wants to have a global force presence to whatever degree it can. And it is at present far away from that goal. It is even far away from the goal of projecting effective power in the Indian Ocean region or in the deeper Western Pacific. So it has a long way to go if it wants to at least even project power in the Indo-Pacific as a geographic region as a whole. So for that, you will need to spend more. You will need to build more capacity. Secondly, when you have built the world's largest naval fleet, you are going to service the fleet. And at least, you know, a significant percent, well over 50-60% of the life cycle cost, 70% of the life cycle cost has to be serviced over the years for this big fleet that you've built. So you will have budgetary allocations for those effects also. So both of these things are happening. There are maintenance costs and there are allocations for new, development. There's been some reports doing the rounds about the potential of a fourth aircraft carrier being unveiled anytime soon right now. So you know that there is going to be much more innovation. So I don't sort of see alarm in the number. It makes sense to me that the numbers will go up. I haven't tabulated the numbers to tell you. And obviously, Beijing does not issue clear details of budgetary allocations for different forces, different sectors, subsectors, whatever. Or say like for pensions, they don't really issue these clarifications. So it's a bit of a challenge to actually break things down. But I would look at it this way, that focus on what kinds of force demonstration is happening and how the approach to utilization of force has changed over the past 4, 5, 6 years. And that tells you much more about Chinese intentions and ambitions than just the allocation number. The allocation number tells you that, yes, these ambitions are there, and that's why you will need to allocate money to them. And that's what's happening. And the commitment to that allocation has to continue. Particularly as your interests and your enterprises continue to go global, you will need to do more of this. So I think that we should expect defense numbers, defense budget increments to remain significant for years to come.
That also makes sense because, you know, some of the sub-targets that, say, the government report talks about, or even those that were highlighted in Xi Jinping's speech to the plenary meeting of the PLA and the PAP, the speeches of the Central Military Commission vice chairman, all of these continue to prioritize what we have commonly come to understand as combat training, which doesn't necessarily translate to war preparedness, although that has been a phrase that has been thrown around a lot. But it does, like you said, mean that continuing to service this huge army of personnel or this huge fleet of vessels to continually refine them, in a way also make new productive forces out of them.
Yeah, I mean, if you like, you reference Xi Jinping's remarks to the PLA and PAP session. In that, I mean, he quite clearly talks about the need to prepare for, you know, need to improve your maritime strategic capabilities, right? Need to prepare for quote unquote maritime military struggles. He talks about, and the speeches that he heard from people were about things like maritime situational awareness, cyber defense, application of AI. So you're going to, and all of these are largely from the perspective of, you know, broader strategic capabilities. So you're going to, you know, they're telling us that we will be investing in these domains. And to do that, you will need to spend more money. And like you referenced, in that speech, he talks about aligning, it's essentially civil-military fusion, right? He's saying that high-quality development of these new quality productive forces shall complement or can complement new quality combat capabilities.
Right.
So he's drawing that link also, right, where the civilian technology will play a role also in military technology, which is interesting. It's useful to note, but it's not novel, right? It's not like the first country in the world to think of civil-military fusion. There are different entities in different countries which do the exact same thing. The Chinese have demonstrated capability to do it, at least to some degree of efficiency. But the Americans do this very well. So it just tells you that you're going to see not just pressure in terms of budget, where there'll be more spending, but also private sector, because you're looking at, new technologies, but also global force projection.
Right. Like you said, a lot of this is repeated, and it's an exercise in just formalizing and codifying repeated emphasis on some of these things. Right? For example, this year, we see the government work report use this specific phrase, right? National defense mobilization, which is a very formalized and codified way of saying the people should love the military and the military should love the people. And it's not new again, but it's just an exercise so that next year when there's the two sessions or when there's a discussion on defense at another plenary meeting, an official can come about and say that this is to implement the spirit of the work report of the two sessions, so on and so forth.
So maybe a movie director can make a movie about some sort of Wolf Warrior 4.0, and that can be classified as government spending because you want to generate affection among the people about the military.
Right. Yeah, no, absolutely. That's exactly what one of the pillars of national defense mobilization is, which is led by this, again, very official entity called the National Defense Mobilization Department of the CMC. And they invest a lot in public information building and red culture exercises. And the Gansu province has been doing a lot of this in the past few months. So absolutely makes sense that it was codified this time. And, on maritime capabilities also, the context is very interesting because we've just seen a very close kind of collision between two Coast Guard vessels of the Philippines and China in the South China Sea. And so, yeah, to have that.
You mean to say the video of that event where a Philippine Coast Guard ship purposefully broke its windows just to taint the water flowing from a Chinese vessel?
Right. I'm so sorry. I misquoted.
Okay, for folks who probably don't know this, you can check out this video. It's available where a Chinese vessel water cannons a Filipino mm-hmm. vessel and shatters their windows in what could have been a really terrible accident. Not accident, but a terrible, terrible outcome. Just an example of the kind of unnecessary aggression and assertiveness from Beijing.
Right, exactly. And, on this assertiveness in the South China Sea and what China's external policy priorities are going to be looking like in 2024, another interesting bit from the two sessions is, of course, Wang Yi's press conference, where a lot of the foreign policy goals were discussed. I think he talked about everything under the sun, from what China and ASEAN need to do to maintain peace and stability in the South China Sea, to what China's policy on brokering peace in the China Ukraine war has been like. Nothing of note to me especially, but did anything stand out to you, Manoj, and what would you say are emerging as priorities for Chinese foreign policy this year?
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, it was a lot of it is repeated usage of certain language, but I think that there were some interesting things in what he did say, right? For example, for starters, I think from an Indian point of view, it's really useful to note that there was not a single mention of India in this entire conversation, which is something that we need to note. It's a reflection of the nature of the bilateral relationship. Now, it is not like India is usually high priority, in this conversation. But you tend to sometimes get questions from an Indian journalist. Of course, this is very choreographed. But there was no mention even in passing of India or the China-India relationship. He talked about the idea of, you know, some really key things for people to take away, right? You know, this idea of building a community for a shared future for mankind. He called this the quote unquote core aspect of Xi Jinping thought on diplomacy, which is important because it tells you that it is the overarching objective of Chinese foreign policy. What this community of shared future for mankind means, for that, I will link to my latest publication, and you can actually go through that because it's quite a complex thing to explain very briefly. But it's something that I think is useful for people to know. He talked about the priorities of Chinese foreign policy for 2024. And I think it's useful to note because often when we talk about China in our, from an Indian lens, we tend to always see that, oh, look, China is isolated. It's created so many enemies in India, Japan, Australia, US, you know, Europeans and so on and so forth. But I think it's important to note that Chinese foreign policy does not see themselves as isolated. And I don't think that they are isolated, which is reflected in, say, UNGA voting on certain issues. And he makes that case, right, where he says that, look, we are going to consolidate and expand our global network of partnerships. And he lists out these partnerships, right, with countries in Africa, with countries in East Asia, with countries in Middle East and Latin America and Eastern Europe. So there's a whole world literally out there, which Beijing is quite actively engaged with. So we shouldn't be buying this idea of isolation. Yes, with major powers, it's picked fights. And that's where its primary problem is, a failure of its foreign policy and its primary problems that lie. He also talked about how, China's advocacy for, say, the interests of developing countries and positioning China as, again, a leader of the global south. Again, not new, but it's useful to keep in mind that this is something that is going to be a key part of Chinese diplomacy and will also be perhaps a key point of friction, continued friction between India and China. Specific references to China-US ties, I think his big spiel on the US from a narrative point of view was really impressive, where he talks about the fact that, and I'll quote some bits of it, where he says that, if the US becomes nervous and anxious at the mention of the word China, then what does it tell you about the confidence of a major power? If the US is only focused on its own prosperity and does not allow others to develop legitimately, then what does it tell you about international justice? So I think that there are, and he gives these sort of rhetorical flourishes, while also saying that, look, China wants to work on some sort of an equilibrium with the US, and the meeting between Biden and Xi in San Francisco was a step in that direction. On ties with Russia, he talks about the relationship being at a really, really good place. He says that, and again, I'll quote this, as major powers, China and Russia have created a new paradigm of major power relations, which is completely different from the Cold War era. So he's basically saying we're not allies, but there's a different proximity to this relationship, which is not akin to an alliance. That means that expectations are very different. He also says that primary objective in this context with ties with Russia is to make sure that you end up creating a multipolar, more democratized international order and maintain global strategic stability amongst major powers. So it tells you a little bit about what the relationship is like. Very quickly, last two points, although there's lots more that I can talk about, but last two points is that on Palestine, again, lots of rhetorical flourish about every life being of value and so on and so forth. And that what's happening in Gaza is a humanitarian disaster, which is a shame for humanity and also civilization. But he says, essentially repeats the idea of a two-state solution. And he talks about the need for a larger peace conference, which is not new, but it's a reiteration of the Chinese position. On Ukraine, he made a very interesting proposal, which is that you need to have a peace conference and China will support a peace conference, but it wants all peace proposals on the table, which basically means that, they're not essentially going in there. Say what the Ukrainians have been trying to do is to get the Chinese to agree to the Zelensky plan. That's not really happening. And while he's saying this, the special envoy of China, Li Hui, he's been in the region. And all the reporting that's coming out of it tells us basically China is not serious about any resolution or even listening to the Europeans. It's basically been parroting Russian lines. And that's annoyed the Europeans, right? So it tells you that, but Beijing wants to play a little bit more of a role because here it's saying that we want to be on some sort of an international conference, which I would assume is not in Chinese interests. Why would they want to be on that conference? Unless, of course, that conference discusses some sort of a new European, but also Indo-Pacific architecture, right? There have to be some parallels. So those, I think, are some of the takeaways. There's much more, but I'll leave it at that. And if people are interested, an entire English version of the press conference is available. People can go and read it.
Right. That's actually a lot of important points of note. And, you know, now that I think about it, even on Taiwan, there was a very interesting comment that Wang Yi made. And this is a loose English translation where he said that, "I believe that there will be a family photo of the whole international community in which all members uphold the One China principle. And it is only a matter of time." So essentially, that kind of tells you that there are more of Taiwanese diplomatic allies to be poached, and the mission is not over yet. And only then will this international community be full.
It's a good point that you raise. It's not just about more allies to be poached, because there are hardly any remaining. But it is a case, and he says this, right? Since the elections that happened in January, more than 180 countries and international organizations have reaffirmed their commitment to the One China principle, which is different from policy, and you know that better than me. And he talks about how that is going to be, like you said, the family photo. And that's not a loose translation. That's the actual translation that he said, that, you know, that that is what we will create. He's basically saying that we are aggressively going to go out and link our engagement with countries on adherence to One China principle, which basically means that the PRC is the legitimate representative of China and Taiwan is a part of the PRC. And I think that he's basically saying that this is what we will, that we are going to advocate as international law. And not agreeing with this is not agreeing with international law. So, and again, like I said, you've recently put out a document in which you've made, explained why that is not the case and why that is not international law. And I really encourage people to read it. We should share it in the share notes, in the show notes. That's a big point that he's making, that you will see far more aggressive, not just efforts to poach allies of Taiwan, but also far more aggressive efforts to generate conformity in others' actions with regard to what the PRC describes as adherence to the One China principle. So whether it is India, whether it is, you know, Saudi Arabia, whether it is another country in Europe, certain kinds of actions which previously seemed fine will be pushed back on. So I think that that is something. Now we have to see, right, whether this implies that visits by legislators of other countries to Taiwan is something that Beijing will set as a new benchmark, that we don't like it. I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. But that's the implication of what he's saying.
Mm-hmm. Right. No. That's definitely going to be a really fascinating kind of watch in the coming months. And you know, we talk a lot about the escalatory ladder and what events can exactly contribute to or take away from the building of an escalatory ladder that may eventually lead to a conflict. And from pressuring other countries to adopt and imbibe the One China principle to other countries responding by sending their parliamentary delegations. Anything can make or break the cross-straits dynamic. With that, we'll conclude the episode. Thank you so much, Manoj, for your insights. I think the NPC has set the stage for another year of fun-filled China watching. And I hope our listeners also enjoyed tuning into yet another episode of All Things Policy. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week. Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.